Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. Over the last 4 years, Your Legal Rights has done its very best to keep you informed about the many legal issues surrounding the last presidential administration and the last election. We've discussed impeachment, presidential pardons, immigration reform, martial law, and the Insurrection Act, to name but a few. After the election on our show December 30th, we explored what might happen if a defeated Donald Trump did the unthinkable and challenged Congress's count of the nation's electoral votes. That chilling possibility materialized on January 6th when then-President Trump's supporters stormed the nation's capital just as Congress attempted to count electoral votes and certify the presidential election. As you know, President Trump did reluctantly leave the White House. He and his followers have since perpetuated what has come to be known as the big lie, namely that the election was stolen. Republican state legislatures have introduced a vast number of measures that appear to be designed to prevent the extraordinary voter turnout that put Donald Trump out of the White House. Donald Trump remains the leader of the Republican Party, and there are those who say that he's not done with our democracy. So tonight, our topic is, will he return? Is our democracy still in crisis? Your freedoms, your rights, democracy itself could be at stake. Here, so much more than ever, let us hear from you. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. Again, we're at 415-841-4134. If you're not here, if you're outside the Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. Again, our number is 866-798-8255. As always, we want to know what's on your mind. Your questions don't have to be on the same topic that we're discussing on the air. You don't have to be at the exact same moment. Our discussion's wide open, and we invite any questions or comments that you might have. But please remember that our attorney guest can't give you specific legal advice about your specific cases. We don't have all the salient facts of your case. But again, anything you wish to talk about, our phone number is 415-841-4134 or 866-798-8255. With us tonight to walk us through this latest crisis of our republic, Professor Lawrence Douglas. Professor Douglas is the James J. Grossfield Professor of Law, Jurisprudence, and Social Thought at Amherst College. Professor Douglas is the author of Will He Go? Trump and the Looming Electoral Meltdown in 2020, in which he described what would happen if Donald Trump lost the 2020 election. And his predictions in that book, if you haven't read it, his predictions were spot on. Also joining us tonight is Dean Johnson. Dean is a practicing attorney and an Emmy-nominated legal and political analyst, and also the founder of Pundit Network, a social media network that uses the wisdom of the crowds to forecast the news, because no one of us is as smart as all of us. With that, thank you both for joining us.
Thanks, Jeff. Great to be here.
My pleasure to be back with you.
Dean, like many of your colleagues in the media, you've said that you're worried about the future of American democracy. Can you tell us why?
Yeah, I am concerned. As political scientists, we're always taught that democracy is a very fragile blossom. And when you think about it, it really is a miracle that in a set of political institutions, the electorate can vote. And in a real democracy, a leader who is in power will voluntarily step down. That's certainly the exception rather than the rule. But it is also true that democracies frequently degenerate into autocracies and dictatorships. And Donald Trump, during his administration, showed all of the signs of being a wannabe autocrat. Yet, in 2020, more people voted for Donald Trump than they had in 2016. He was defeated only because of a massive, unprecedented voter turnout. And now Republican state legislatures in Texas, Georgia, and several other states have introduced bills that are designed to suppress this kind of voter turnout in the future. the next elections are really up in the air. Democrats in both the House of Representatives and the Senate have razor-thin margins. And if that turnout is suppressed, if voters don't come out in the numbers that they did for the 2020 election, Democrats may very well lose their majority in both houses. At the same time, as the Nobel Prize-winning economist Paul Krugman has recently said, the Republican Party, the party out of power, now is exhibiting all of the attributes of the ruling party of a classic autocracy. So is our democracy in peril? I think it is. I'm very concerned. And that's what we want to talk about tonight.
Professor Douglas, let's be honest. You nailed it. In your book, you painted a vivid picture of Donald Trump challenging the results of the presidential election and the culmination of that challenge in a constitutional meltdown. And you didn't just pick a random date. You actually said you predicted the meltdown on January 6th. So how does it feel to be a prophet?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to do too much of in the way of self-congratulation. It is true that my wife some years ago bought me a little crystal ball, but I don't think the crystal ball is really what guided my prognostications. I think it was really more just kind of looking at the statements that Donald Trump had made in the past and just taking him at face value. All along, he had said that he would refuse to accept electoral defeat, or that he would try to explain an apparent electoral defeat as the result of fraud. Now, once we accept that that was the position he was going to take, all we really had to do was look at some of the important dates that are on our electoral calendar and to really identify January 6th as one of those critical dates. I mean, January 6th, at least in this past election cycle, was the date in which Congress was convening for the purposes of certifying the election. And so basically that was really the last date on which Trump and Trump's allies could try to kind of make their last stand. So, you know, I think all I really did was kind of, again, take him at his face value and then to look at the sort of the vulnerable points of contact along the way in which someone who was engaged in some type of electoral defiance would try to the vulnerabilities they would try to exploit.
You know, we set up a show that we would be talking about the past, the present, the future, looking at how we got here, where we are now, and what this all means. Where is it likely to turn out? But before we get there, there's been something I've been teasing Dean about for weeks, completely unrelated to the show tonight. Can't we just send in troops or remove troops from southern red states? I mean, can't we just pull our troops back and say, let's just call it a day and everything gets better?
Well, you know, we tried that once. It was a thing called the Compromise of 1867. And it's amazing how that situation parallels what we're seeing today. There was a shortly after the Civil War, there was a disputed presidential election between Rutherford B. Hayes and Samuel J. Tilden. The Congress tried to figure out how to break a tie in the Electoral College, and eventually they reached a compromise, which sounded like a great idea. And Samuel J. Tilden withdrew, and Rutherford B. Hayes became president. And the compromise was that in exchange for Tilden's withdrawal, the troops that were occupying the South during the period of what we call Reconstruction would be withdrawn, which sounded like a great thing as well. And in a lot of ways, it saved us from a second Civil War. But there were unintended consequences. The unintended consequence was that in the South, Southern Democrats who were then in power instituted a whole range of what came to be known as Jim Crow laws, voter suppression laws. And black citizens in the South were essentially excluded from the polls, disenfranchised for approximately 100 years. And you have to wonder, we now have another disputed election. The dispute is mostly in the minds of people like Donald Trump and his followers. It's not a real dispute supported by evidence. But what we're seeing looks very much like the Republicans drawing on that old Southern Reconstruction, post-Reconstruction Jim Crow playbook, because we have seen literally hundreds of voter suppression laws introduced now in 49 states and many passed. And of course, just last week, we saw the Democrats leave the state of the Democratic state legislators in Texas, leave the state of Texas in order to avoid having a voter suppression law enacted there. History repeats itself if you don't learn its lessons.
Yeah, if I could just follow up on that very briefly. You know, when we talk about that that compromise of 1877, very often we think of it as a compromise that that avoided what looked like a true electoral meltdown. That is, this was, as Dean already pointed out, it really was an example of our electoral college very badly misfiring and having a real crisis land in the hands of Congress, where Congress basically was unable to figure out who the next president of the United States would be. But as Dean well pointed out, that the solution to that, to what could have been electoral catastrophe, was really a disaster. And it was a disaster in particular for Black Americans, because exactly as Dean points out, it really paved the way for the passage of these Jim Crow laws, basically the creation of a system of racial apartheid in the South. And then we continue to see the legacy of that today.
Go ahead, Dean. I've got a caller on the line, but I'll let you finish your thought first.
And, you know, it's ironic that that compromise actually resulted in the Electoral Count Act, which is the script for that Baroque play that we saw being played out just before the January 6th election or insurrection at the Capitol. And it didn't work. And perhaps we need to start thinking about reforms for the Electoral Count Act and for that whole process, maybe avoid the kind of meltdowns that we saw on January 6th.
Yes, and sure, go ahead, Jeff, and we can then circle back maybe to the Electoral Count Act at some point.
I'm more than happy to circle back to it, but I think we have somebody with some interesting ideas on the line. Let me turn it to Nomi from San Francisco. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Yes, hi. Thank you. I love this show. I appreciate all your guests. I'm an African-American woman about 60 years old who's seen it all, seen a lot, and continuously to see history repeating itself as it is now. I'm wondering, what is different now than 50 years ago? Where are we at now? I know you're probably not African-American, but I'm saying we in general as a culture, and I'm also including African-American in terms of political power, social power, economic power. Where are we now where we can overcome this historical moment that's repeating itself again? What have we done so differently that we may not go down that same trajectory and have a different outcome?
Before you jump off the air, and I appreciate you taking a call off the air, on the air, but I did want to ask you, if I understand you correctly, would you really want to know from our guests, have we really become so much more inclusive that people of color won't soon face the same setbacks that they did 50 years ago, 150 years ago, various times cyclically throughout our history?
Yes, I'm talking more specifically about the African-American voter, but I will be more inclusive and add people of color as well, because I think the Latino voter is really high. You know, folks of Asian diaspora vote high as well. Like inclusive and even further than just inclusivity, but more like what has changed in the power structure and the dynamic in Congress, in the Senate, you know, at the local gubernatorial level, the local level, where is there enough power structure that we have now that we can overcome this sort of attempt to repeat history again? Are we stronger now than we were before and more united, I guess?
And I think your points are well taken. And before my guest answer, I think what you'd look, if you look back through history, you'd find that African Americans in the South suffered from these a similar type of a history as perhaps Hispanic Americans mostly Mexican Americans in the southwestern United States, within the red states, very similar paths.
Sure.
We don't talk about all of them as much, but I think the real question is, have we set up a structure that preserves a certain level of participation in the system where rights are preserved and where people aren't going to face those kinds of setbacks?
Exactly.
Thank you. I appreciate
that.
It's a very well-thought question, and I'll turn it over to my guests.
Thank you.
Well, a great question, and I think the answer is what we're learning is that the power structure hasn't changed very much. I mean, what's shocking is that we're looking over a period of some, 150 years, and the same playbook is being played out again. And we're seeing, we're seeing efforts by a party that lost at the polls because of massive turnout, largely on the part of minority voters, trying to do everything it can again to keep minority voters away from the polls, and using the exact same playbook, in some ways borrowing almost verbatim from post-Civil War Jim Crow laws. I guess the answer is the logic of politics plays out over and over again. And we have to remember that it took literally 100 years for the consequences of that compromise and the creation of the Jim Crow laws to be addressed by Congress, as it was in the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And now here we are again. And to its credit, Congress did respond or tried to respond with the For the People Act, which was designed to set national voting standards and to counter a lot of the efforts at voter suppression. But right now, in terms of our power structure, the institutions are paralyzed. That the For the People Act died in Congress because Republicans threatened filibuster. And there's nothing really on the horizon to change that. So I think the only answer is we put it back in the hands of the people. And what was done to bring out this massive turnout in 2020 has to be done again, but it has to be raised to a new level. There has to be more and better organization to circumvent all of these restrictive statutes.
And if I can just follow up on what Dean's point, I mean, I also thought that Nomi's question was very well taken. On the other hand, one thing we can point out is that in many ways, the 2020 vote was a resounding success of the power of Black voters. I mean, it really was Black voters who are responsible for Joe Biden's presidential victory. And at the same time that we see these various states trying to now engage in this this tired playbook of voter suppression, we also see other states that are trying to make voting easier. And I think just as Dean pointed out, I think ultimately it will turn on the people, because these efforts at disenfranchising are – what they will do is they will encumber the right to vote. They will make it more difficult. They will not bar people from voting, as was the case, let's say, during the real kind of Jim Crow period. And so if you have adequate resources, organization to get out the vote, even these cynical and frankly racist efforts on the part of these various states can be defeated.
One of the things that I took from the last two elections is the knowledge that we're still, to a certain extent, we're still a pluralist society. And there are fringe elements, whether it's because of minority status, whether it's because they don't tolerate minorities, whether it's because they're far right, whether it's because they're far left. And neither side right now is willing to offend the outside elements. They're no longer crowding for the middle, which makes it a very different form of democracy than we've seen in recent years. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. We're joined tonight by Professor Lawrence Douglas of Amherst College and Emmy-nominated legal and political analyst Dean Johnson. And tonight we're taking a look at the fragile state of our democracy. If you have questions for our guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic, whether it's the divisions amongst us or the nationalism or whatever it may be. You're not limited to the point we may be discussing in our conversation. One of the things that we wanted to talk about tonight for certain is how we got here. You know, we look at somebody like a President Trump and the nationalism and some of the people he was touting to build his coalition. And is he really the cause of the current crisis, or is he the effect of the current crisis? I mean, what are the roots of this wave of populism and nationalism that got us here?
Well, you know, I think that's a great question, Jeff, and it's a big question. And I tend to look at Donald Trump as more effect than cause. And I'm kind of unique in the media because my colleagues in the media like to make it simple. And making it simple means blame Donald Trump for everything. But what we forget is historically, this populist movement wasn't confined to the United States. There are Donald Trumps, in quotes, in a number of other countries. And it started long before Donald Trump even announced his candidacy. We remember the Tea Party. And we remember Mitch McConnell saying that we're going to make Barack Obama a one-term president. So those roots were there for this kind of movement. And Donald Trump's genius, if there is such a thing, was that he saw it coming and he was able to exploit it. It could have been somebody else. As it happened, he just played the role that inevitably somebody would play, which is a potential autocrat in the midst of our democracy.
While I don't disagree with you, watching him for quite some time, if you look back at his history, it looks like he was moving in that direction for a decade before he finally ran for the presidency. And while he was still spending money to both sides, you look at the groups he was courting, you looked at the activities he did outside, such as his playing around at the World Wrestling Federation used to be. And you see him posturing himself, and it just seems like he was getting himself to the right spot, and just the perfect opening came up for him, as I see it.
Yeah, I think that's right. He was the right man for the job in the right place at the right time. But the groundwork had to be there. We know why democracies degenerate into autocracies, and one thing that has to be there is a large part of the population that, for lack of a better word, fears that it's going to be replaced. And globally, as well as in the United States, we do have a large segment of the population for whom the bottom dropped out. All of the low-skilled jobs disappeared. They went overseas or they were replaced by machines. And the top became unreachable. The good jobs now required graduate degrees, which they didn't have. And a lot of these people have been, you know, thousands of these people have been interviewed and talked to about why they support Trump, why they're part of the support base, why they're part of the base. And the word they always use is replacement. We feared being replaced. And that's what leads to fringe political behavior inevitably, is that people just fear that their entire way of life is about to go away and that they're going to be replaced in what they feel as their entitled position by some other group in society.
Yeah, I would agree very much with what Dean was saying. And in addition to the notion of replacement, there was a great 19th century French sociologist named Emile Durkheim who really talked about the loss of status. And when people feel their status being threatened, a status that they're used to, it also becomes just a very toxic situation in which you know, the voice of a demagogue resonates, you know, pretty powerfully. And I think I also agree with Dean that I think even the whole way of thinking just in terms of cause and effect might be a little misleading. Obviously, I mean, even if, you know, maybe it's inappropriate for me to talk about all the environmental dislocations in California right now. But, you know, obviously you have certain conditions that create the opportunities for a raging conflagration. And those conditions were there. But you still needed that spark and that hot wind to blow, and Trump certainly was that hot wind that blew and really turned these kind of local brush fires into a real political conflagration in this country.
You know, in listening to some of these folks being interviewed, I found it rather interesting in the last 7-8 years to hear people talk instead of looking for people to look up to. As their leaders, they're looking for people that talk like they do because it sounds safer. Mara from San Francisco, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Oh, yeah. Hi. Thank you so much for this program. I just wanted to sort of ask a question, and it's sort of on the level of just I'm wondering how sort of mathematics, technology, and wealth consolidation are relating to this problem. Specifically, I mean, we have a two-party political system, but it's sort of commonly understood in sociology that there are three social classes. So I just was wondering if you could sort of address how, at the level of reason, we sort of think about these issues and how that relates to technology and you know, numbers, money. So I'll take the answer off the air. Thank you so much. Bye.
Thank you for joining us. Professor?
Well, I'm not sure if I have, you know, any kind of a brilliant response to Mira's question. I mean, obviously, one of the things that we've seen in recent decades is this this incredible widening of the gap between the wealthy and we're not just talking about the wealthy; we're talking about the super wealthy and basically other mainstream Americans. We're not even necessarily talking about people. We're not talking about poor Americans. We're talking about working class Americans. And that is another, source of toxicity in our politics. Though I think one thing we always need to keep in mind in the United States is that issues of class always have to be refracted also through the lens of race. That racial politics plays such an incredibly powerful role, even when it's not necessarily being explicitly discussed as such. So, but I do think that the kind of the mix of race and class has certainly led to the kind of vulnerabilities in American politics that we see today.
And not just class, not just money, but power, Dean.
Yeah, I totally agree with Lawrence. And it's a great question. There's so many factors that led up to Donald Trump's election. There's a saying that history is always overdetermined. There are more causes for any particular effect than one. It's certainly true that there's a large class of people who feel left out of the technological revolution. They're in many ways their jobs and their lifestyles are replaced by technology. The recession of 2008, we had a recovery, partly because of some fairly wise government programs. 80 to 90% of that recovery went to the people who are in the top 1% of our income. Our level of inequality has increased massively. The average worker, the median worker in this country, hasn't had a raise in real terms since 1972. And those people are being left behind by what has happened to America in the 21st century. And they're looking for somebody who speaks their language and who understands that.
And with that,
Donald Trump, unfortunately.
It's interesting that they would select somebody who may talk like them, but he's actually one of the people that ended up with all the money. You're listening to Your Legal Rights. We'll be back right after this.
Hey, I'm Ali Hassan in for Tom Power. Cassie Cow didn't just dip her toe in when she started comedy. She dove in headfirst with a challenge, 100 days of stand-up. It worked. She quit her desk job, and now she's getting ready for the Just for Last Comedy Festival. Cassie will tell you her story. That's coming up on Q from PRX.
Thank you, Finnish CBC. Tonight at 7 o'clock, followed by 8 o'clock's One Way Possible. Right here on member-supported 91.7 FM and online at kalw.org. Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. You can call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org.
And let me turn it over to Mark from San Francisco. You're on the air. Welcome to your legal rights.
Hi, thank you. I have two points I'd like to have the panel discuss. One is that it seems as though there is something about elections and the procedure of our government, of democratic government, that relies on a kind of decorum and the willingness of, say, the participants to back down and hand over power when they lose an election, and that seems very delicate. And another thing, it seems that one thing that Trump was able to do early on during the primaries and the debates was he understood how to command control of media, and that acting like a buffoon and lying and being outrageous would put him at the center of attention, and that is something that led to him being victorious and continuing on in behaving that same sort of way. So I suppose those things are related, that there's a sense of how to behave, and that's very fragile. So I wonder about that, and also the role of media in all of this.
Well, thank you for joining us, and I appreciate your taking your call off the air. One of the things that Mark brings out is that President Trump was, long before he took the White House, an expert in branding. He knew that anything that put him in front of the camera led to good publicity, and in the end, he could be as outrageous as he wanted to. He got the airtime, which is really what he wanted. But Mark did ask a very valid question. What happened to decorum?
Well, I think, if I can just respond to that, I think it's more than just decorum. It's the norms that underlie a system. I think anytime you talk about a democratic system, no system in a sense can protect itself unless people are willing to, in a way, play by the rules. That is, you can't just end up layering law upon law upon law in order to make sure that people are following the law. At some point, there really needs to have some kind of buy-in. And there's nothing more basic than the buy-in of recognizing when you've lost an election. And in a certain sense, it goes back to the point that Dean had made earlier about the vulnerabilities of democracy. The notion of conceding in an election is a very unusual notion. You basically are recognizing the legitimacy of your defeat. That is what the act of conceding is. And a democracy presupposes it. It can't function without it. And yet we've seen that there's no necessary reason to assume that people are going to continue to buy into that. And especially, and I think this is one of the things that makes us so worried about the present moment, is you would think that if someone doesn't buy into such a basic norm of the system, they would have to suffer some kind of severe penalty. They would have to, in some sense, be penalized for that rejection. And Trump hasn't. He just has not had to pay the price. And I think that's the thing that makes the one of the things that I find most worrisome about the present political moment, the way in which he continues to be the predominant force in the Republican Party and the way in which his enablers or the members of the Republican Party remain in thrall of him.
You know, as much as we... Dean, go ahead.
So, yeah, I totally agree. In fact, when our caller Mark was speaking, I wrote down on my notebook the word norms. And that's important. As Professor Douglas points out, democracies can't function without a certain number of unwritten rules and a certain, set of rules for how we proceed, even though they're not statutes. In fact, two Harvard political scientists, Levitsky and Ziblatt, recently wrote a book called How Democracy Dies. And one of their points is that democracies turn into autocracies when those norms disappear. And they have disappeared from our democracy. Norms like mutual tolerance, where you understand that your opponents may have different views, but they are professionals like you with a job to do, and their views, their ability to express their views are mutually tolerated. Forbearance. You don't use the nuclear options like the executive order or the filibuster without really, really good reason. And also deference. You defer to people in power, even though you may be in the party that's out of power. For example, we had a tradition with Supreme Court nominees that the president gets the nominee he wants if that nominee is competent. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the most liberal nominee possibly of all time, was confirmed 96-0. We don't see that today. Those norms are rapidly disappearing, and with it, the fabric of our democracy is coming unraveled.
We spoke of this a bit earlier, and I think in all fairness, we're pointing the finger in a particular direction. And I think there's plenty of finger pointing that we could do here. And just as we get offended when people in this part of the country who lean in a particular direction see things such as the governor of Texas threatening to arrest all of his political opponents when they return to the state because they left, we also see in other parts of the country, such as in New York, where they're rapidly ramping up the prosecution of President Trump and the people around him and really looking for ways to dismantle his political machine. And it just goes to what you were saying about putting aside norms and actually talking about jailing your opponents, which is a new territory for us. I do want to move on a bit. But one of the factors that I think led to this I wanted to ask about, and that is we used to have political parties that tried to bring in everybody they could. They were a big tent. They strove for the middle and then reached out. And it seems that that's really given way to this extreme polarization and instead reaching for further and further extremes, knowing that if you offend somebody at the extreme, it's part of your base going away and you're at a disadvantage. How did we get there? What actually happened to these big tent parties, and how does that affect the process?
Well, one thing I might push back a little bit on, Jeff, is I do think that there's a kind of a myth of symmetric polarization. I mean, I think the polarization that we see in this country is asymmetric. And I do think that it is important to note that we now have one major party in our country, the Republican Party, which in certain very basic ways is not buying into the democratic system. I don't think you can make a similar charge at this stage about the Democratic Party. And again, this is not meant to romanticize the Democratic Party, but I do think it is important to emphasize that difference. And actually, just to go back a moment, I also would push back against your point that that we're trying to jail political opponents by investigating President Trump and his business practices before he became president. I mean, I think one of the things we also should note is that in a society that abides by the rule of law, which is something that we at least aspire to, such a system, such a nation has to be capable of bringing to trial former leaders who have broken laws. I mean, if I had engaged in the kind of illicit business practices that the Trump Organization is accused of, I would be in trouble. So I don't think it's necessarily the case where I think you're absolutely right that there's something deeply problematic about using the arm of the criminal law to settle scores with enemies. That's very different than actually affirming the importance of the rule of law by bringing a former ruler to account for criminal actions.
Let me turn it over to Stuart in Berkeley. Welcome to Your Legal Rights. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm interested in putting a question to you about what I see as mass psychosis going on amongst one part of society. There seems to be, in my view, a detachment from reality, and I'm seeing this in a number of ways. One is the disregard of institutional knowledge about vaccinations, pursuance of QAnon, refusing to accept the elections despite the fact that all the courts have ruled against Trump. So I'm interested in you looking at the social and psychological aspects of the lack of willingness to accept what has previously been seen as being reality. And it seems to me that this psychosis has been growing over the last few years and being fueled by Trump.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. As I think I've mentioned, I often communicate with my folks back home who are part of the Trump base. And the impression I always walk away with is that they're living in an alternate universe. They're not living on the same planet as me. Studies show that right now, 15% of Americans, not Republicans, 15% of Americans, but give some credence to the QAnon conspiracy theory. 67% of Republicans believe that the election was stolen. Many Republicans believe that the January 6th insurrection that Professor Douglas predicted and that we all saw on television never happened, that those were just tourists having a typical day touring the Capitol.
May I make a second point?
Sure,
related to that what I see in individuals, I'm not talking about politics, but in individuals who have psychosis, sometimes there can be an element of trauma. That's not always the case, but it frequently is. So I'm wondering whether this detachment from reality is related to deep trauma by a large segment of the population.
You know, it's possible, but I think there are two things going on. One is what we call confirmation bias, is that a lot of these people who are living in this alternative universe started out with the belief that, you know, the media were lying to them and the world was very different from what was being portrayed. And so they go searching for things that confirm that belief. And the other is what we call the silo effect. A lot of these people get almost all of their news now from social media like Facebook. And the algorithms of social media are designed to reinforce whatever you want to look at and what you want to hear. So if you're looking at right-wing media posts on Facebook, then you're going to get more right-wing media posts and not somebody who believes the opposite or somebody who wants to steer you straight.
Yeah, and I would just—I think the point that Dean made is important, because I think one thing is we should avoid doing is pathologizing other people. And I think you know, when we talk in terms of mass psychosis, we're really treating people as if they're suffering from some kind of pathology. And I think it's more helpful, as Dean points out, to realize that there have been, you know, structural changes within, let's say, our media universe, so that people are now getting fed unreliable information. And it, you know, if you're constantly fed unreliable information and there ends up being these feedback loops and you have this highly siloed media environment that Dean described, that becomes a source of misinformation and misbelief. And so we don't necessarily need to resort to principles of abnormal psychology in order to understand some of the beliefs that we find Americans now sharing.
Yeah, and one thing to add to that is that what Donald Trump did, what he did so brilliantly, was to close that loop so that people can never escape from this web of disinformation. Anytime you approach people with action who live in that alternative universe, in that distorted reality, you approach them with actual facts, it's very easy for them to dismiss it with two words: fake news.
Fake news, exactly.
And that is something interesting. I saw a commentary with former Presidents Clinton and Bush being interviewed, and they shared an interesting observation that we no longer have a central, more neutral body of the press, but instead we have all this media and everybody on both sides, and it's really two sides. It's no longer a body politic. It's really two distinct sides. Look for things that reinforce what they already believe and their belief system, rather than trying to find out better ideas. And more, I'm finding people with lots and lots of opinions about places they've never been, people they've never met, because that's the way it's portrayed. Stuart, thank you for joining us in Your Legal Rights.
Thank you. Can I just follow up with that, Jeff? Because I think one point that you made, which is, I think, very, very important, is, you know, I think people overlook at the role that the decline of local newspapers have played in the poisoning of this media environment, because I think local news brings people in contact with the world that they're familiar with, and it's a world in which they can, in a sense, test the propositions that are being reported. And I think as people move away, as these local sources of local news have been basically run out of business, and people rely exclusively on national news. National news, it's a world apart, and it's a world in which reality can kind of be supplanted by fantasy.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. We're joined tonight by Professor Lawrence Douglas of Amherst College and Emmy-nominated legal and political analyst Dean Johnson. Tonight, we're taking a look at the fragile state of our democracy. If you have questions for our guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. We still have a few minutes left for you to call at 866-798-8255. 8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic, whether it's the divisions amongst us or how we got there or the new nationalism. You're not limited to the exact point in our conversation that we may be sitting. And we've talked a lot about how we got here, but with what time we have remaining, I really want to take a look at where we are right now. We've been talking about the voter reform legislation in the states. What's the state of this so-called reform legislation?
Well, right now, as of last month, there were 389 bills introduced in 49 states that were arguably voter suppression bills. 17 states have passed bills like that. And of course, the most famous are Texas and Georgia. Georgia is in the process of enacting a broad voter suppression act that, among other things, famously requires that people not give water or food to anyone who's standing in line to vote. In Texas, as we pointed out earlier, the Democrats from the state legislature have actually left the state, and the governor is threatening to arrest them if they return. They left the state so that the state legislature could not maintain a quorum in its special session and vote those voter suppression acts into law. But they are gradually becoming into law. Obviously, if the special session ends, another special session can be called again and again and again. And we're going to be facing a very different legal framework in 2022 and possibly in 2024.
And if I can just add one thing to Dean's observation, that, you know, some of these laws are not just about voter suppression. I think one of the most disturbing aspects about them is that they're lowering the bar for partisans to challenge and alter election results. So, for example, in Texas, partisans would no longer need to show that improper votes had materially affected the outcome of an election in order to try to reverse the results. And I think that's one of the things that's also most disturbing about these, about, in a sense, this effort to operationalize the big lie.
Let me turn it over to George in San Francisco. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Well, thanks. You know, before it gets too late, we were hoping that we would hear some discussion of who's attempting to get the most favorable position to get into the I hesitate to call them Republicans, but to get into the mass consciousness of the people that are currently jostling each other for advantageous positions with to suppose that Trump isn't around anymore, that something happens to him or that he gives up. He's certainly not the only character on the horizon. And what do we have to say to the question, who's going to be the next hot shot?
George,
juggling to get into it?
George, thank you for your question, which I think is well brought up, and I appreciate your taking your answer on the air. And what George is asking is really simple. Who's lined up next? Trump may be moving on, but Trumpism is far from it. Who's the next up in this war of words, this war of ideas, and who's really breaking through?
Well, I think the quick answer is right now, nobody, because the structure of the Republican Party right now is you show absolute devotion to Donald Trump in the most elaborate and diffusive and humiliating way you possibly can, and nobody talks about successors or replacements. If I had to guess, if, say, Donald Trump, who is 75 years old, isn't around in 2024, I would guess another member of the Trump family, because that's the way they're going. This is turning into an autocratic party along the lines of Caligula's courtiers or Kim Jong-un's Communist Party in North Korea.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we have other people who would be like jockeying to assume the mantle of Trump, and, you know, people, obvious choices like Josh Hawley or, you know, Ted Cruz. But I think Dean's point is also well taken. I mean, one thing about Trump is there really is a kind of cult of personality that surrounds him. And cults of personality don't translate very easily. They don't actually pass on from one person to another very easily. So it's not clear exactly who would assume that mantle.
Ben from San Francisco, you're in Your Legal Rights.
Hello. Can everybody hear me?
Yes, you're on the air and our time is short, so if you would jump
in. Okay. In the last 250-odd years of the United States existence, you've only had one election that was democratic, and that was because you were forced by the coronavirus to send a ballot to every citizen, something you have refused to do in those 250 years. And guess what? 60, 70, 80% of your population voted in 50 states. What is the next thing that you did? Both the Democrats and the Republicans are terrified by a democracy that they never believed in and want to shut it down. That's what all this nonsense is about. And, oh, by the way, Donald Trump lost the election, but I've heard his name more often on all your media than when he was president. This is Goebbels' principle of propaganda, where you keep repeating nonsense and you keep wondering why people believe stupid nonsense, because you keep repeating it. That's why. I mean, and as for a democracy, you've only been a democracy once in your history. And look what you're doing. You're trying to shut it down. So if you really want a democracy, tell the fascist Democrats and the Nazi Republicans to behave themselves. And you all, stop repeating, 7 months, and I've never heard more about the Republicans and white supremacy and all this nonsense. The black vote changed.
Ben, we're essentially out of time, and I can't really let you continue, but thank you for joining us in your legal rights. We do have one time for one quick call from Wendy. We only have a moment or so, but go ahead.
I'm interested in direct democracy. How could that impact our democracy? I'd like to hear the speakers talk on that.
Thank you. And given the echo, I'm going to ask if you would take your call, your answer on the air. We have just about a moment left, a minute left or so, if you want to. Each one.
So, you know, one thing about direct democracy is we do not have a particularly, you know, just to connect what Wendy was saying with Ben's earlier comments. In a certain way, you know, we were constructed as a Republican form of government.
And of course, that's Republican with a small r.
Yes, exactly. Republican with a small r, in the sense that, you know, government is run through our representatives. I think direct democracy works best on a local level. And I think, you know, one of the things that maybe we can learn is that instead of fixating so much on Washington, to look at the kinds of things that we can do on the grassroots level and to, you know, work collectively as citizens. The fact of the matter is, you know, there are many actual constitutional structures that make direct democracy, that were designed to make direct democracy very, very difficult on the national level. So I do think that if we're interested in the power of direct democracy, we can see it play most efficaciously on the local level.
Dean, we have about a minute left. Any comments?
Yep. I think it's pretty clear from what I've said during the preceding hour that I think Americans need to wake up if they haven't already. We need to remember that our military leaders, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, actually assembled 7 months ago to seriously consider what they would do in order to prevent a coup d'etat. And as Professor Douglas so well prophesied, there was an attempted coup d'etat. It failed, fortunately. But the forces that led to the Donald Trump administration, that led to the insurrection on January 6th, are still out there. They're stronger than ever. The people who were committed to Trump are convinced that he lost the election, and they see him as something of a martyr now. We have to wake up. The only answer to the efforts at voter suppression, the only answer to preventing Donald Trump's return, is we have to get out and we have to organize and we have to be engaged in our democracy.
And that will be where we leave it. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. Tonight we've been discussing insurrection, the law, and the fragile state of our democracy. Our guest tonight have been Professor Lawrence Douglas of Amherst College, author of Will He Go? Trump and the Looming Election Meltdown of 2020, and Emmy-nominated legal and political commentator Dean Johnson. Our show tonight has been produced by Dean Johnson and yours truly. Please be sure to join Your Legal Rights again next week, Wednesday at 6 p.m., where we will take a look at the Americans with Disabilities Act, the good, the bad, and the misuse. Again, a big thanks to tonight's guests, and especially our thanks to all of you for joining us. And at the controls, Damian D. Minor. I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night and stay safe.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Law Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. For the details, you can call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org. This is KALW San Francisco.